Good afternoon. I'm Doug Boynton. Education matters to everyone. Today, we continue our series into issues facing today's educators. Why aren't kids coming to school? Statewide, the latest figure is that just over 15% of students are chronically absent. The culture wars again exploded, this time around Chesapeake's schools, when a controversial after-school club petitioned to meet, and a long-standing agreement between two localities to create a unified school division could end soon. Today's guests, Superintendent Dr. Jared Cotton of the Chesapeake City Schools and Dr. Olwen Herron with Williamsburg James City County Schools. We're here to discuss how teachers and administrators are faring as we get to the midpoint of the school year. They'll also take your calls, comments, and questions right after this news break from NPR and the WHRO Newsroom. It's Education Matters. Welcome back. I'm Doug Boynton. Joining me today, two area division superintendents who are guiding their schools through distinct challenges. We are now three, almost 4 years since Governor Northam closed the schools in March of 2020 due to the pandemic, and yet learning loss that many blame on the shuttering is pervasive. SOL scores, standards of learning scores in reading and math declined. Chronic absenteeism, defined as students missing 10 days or more a year, is ongoing. Our guest, Dr. Jared Cotton, head of Chesapeake City Schools. He is a product of that division. He graduated from Great Bridge High School. He's been a classroom teacher, a principal, a technology specialist, and a director of assessment and accountability. He was named superintendent in 2018. Dr. Olwen Herron is a native of Northern Ireland and has been a classroom teacher and administrator. She was the acting superintendent in the Williamsburg James City County Schools prior to be named to lead it in 2017. Our numbers to call if you have questions, 757-440-2665 to join the conversation. Also, your questions and comments may be posted on the WHRO Facebook page. Thank you both for coming. You are not strangers to each other, right?
No, as a matter of fact, we work together. In Virginia Beach a few years ago, right?
Oh. Absolutely. I was director of organizational development, and I believe you were in charge of accountability, Dr. Cotton.
Yep,
we've been good friends for a long time.
As we look at what has happened since the pandemic, it was, I guess, a game changer in many ways. Absenteeism, chronic absenteeism, shot up. The numbers I have for Chesapeake, 13.2%. For Williamsburg, James City County, 16.2%. Governor Youngkin has blamed the previous administration in his all-in VA plan. What are the causes, and what are your districts doing about that, Dr. Cotton?
Great question. Actually, that's certainly something we've been focusing on quite a bit. During the pandemic, of course, you know, many of our students learned from home.
Right.
So as a result, we had to look at how we were engaging our students daily in the instruction, even though they weren't physically in the building. And unfortunately, some of that has carried beyond the pandemic, and we do have issues with absenteeism. I'm happy to say that it continues to improve for us in Chesapeake. And really what we've done to combat the chronic absenteeism, all of our schools have task force in place that are addressing it at the school level. What we have found is not only is it important to address it at the division level, but the schools have to engage in that process as well. And they're doing lots of incentives in their schools to encourage students to come to school and to participate. We had a great campaign along with the state on addressing absenteeism in September, and we did a lot of activities and webinars for our parents, just reinforcing the fact that attendance matters. And fortunately for us, we have seen some improvement.
Dr. Herron?
Yeah, absolutely. Been a quite a challenge for us as well. And we've put a lot of things in place over the last year to address chronic absenteeism. In fact, in December of 2022, when we looked at the numbers, we were trending much worse than where we ended up. We were 27% chronic absenteeism. At that point, we really started working with schools. We have committees at every school. We have an attendance multidisciplinary team in the community with Colonial Behavioral Health, Court Services, Commonwealth Attorney, and Social Services, all working together on chronic absenteeism and meeting monthly to strategize. We have a team at every single school, and we have guidelines for every school to really how to contact parents and involve parents in getting kids back to school. In the last year, we had 961 individual parent meetings about student absenteeism, talking to parents about what are the barriers that stop your child coming to school.
What do you find?
I could give you one example, just a story I got heard recently. We had a senior who wasn't making it to school. And when we got the parent and the student and our staff in a room to talk about it, basically when the parent left for work, the student was falling asleep and not waking up to go to school some of the days and therefore becoming chronically absent. And so we worked with the parent. We set up a process where the parent would use Find My iPhone, wake the child up, and now the student, her attendance is much better. So little into stories like that are throughout our whole school system. But our staff and the school level staff have done a tremendous job in turning everything around. One other thing we really focused on was in communication with families. Our division newsletter, our school newsletters, we had a template where we were provided data. If your child is absent this number of days, this is how it's going to affect their achievement. And so we really focused on individuals and then more broadly as well in communication efforts.
When I was a child in the Stone Age, they threatened the truant officer. And, you know, they would come and knock on the door and say, get your Fanny to school. Do you have truant officers?
We do. Actually, we do have truant officers who do go to homes and follow through with families. But also our school staff go to homes and follow through with families. And Dr. Owen, I appreciate you mentioning the process of engaging the parents, because we have a similar process. Absolutely. In Chesapeake. After a certain number of days, we meet with parents, we talk with them, we include the child and the parents in that conversation, and we come up with a plan, as you've said,
Absolutely.
To help them with their attendance, and that has been effective. But again, it comes down to our staff and our school buildings, who do an incredible job of connecting with students and families, to doing everything we can to make sure that they can attend school.
How much did the pandemic affect? I mean, that was when it ballooned, during and after the pandemic. How much did that have to do with it?
I think it had an incredible effect. I mean, we were at 90% attendance. Only 10% were chronically absent, usually with illness and things like that. But it did obviously get much worse during the pandemic. I mean, if I could give a sense, it's not just the parent conversations. We had 1,600, 1,700 students on academic attendance plans for attendance to change their behavior and try to get them back to school as well. Also, you mentioned the truant officer. We didn't have any in Williamsburg, but we've just are using the all-in funds provided by Governor Youngkin to create a new position, attendance specialist, and that person will be taking the role of a truant officer for us over the next 2 years using all-in funds.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because some of those funds do go towards chronic absenteeism, right. So we have some strategies we put in place to address that as well.
It was not only chronic absenteeism, but test scores went down, and the governor made a lot of, I think, political comments about that, but a lot of it was real as well, right? The test scores did go down.
Absolutely.
Certainly. We all faced challenges during that time. I would say, Dr. Owen, you probably agree, that was probably the most difficult time in our careers, dealing with the pandemic and working through those challenges and making sure all of our students were engaged in learning.
If you have questions or comments, our numbers are 757-440-2665, 800-940-2240. You can also ask your question at the WHRO Facebook page. $418 million, I think that's the number the governor touted when he said was going to be available for school districts. He specifically mentioned at the time tutors. Are you able to find enough tutors to help?
I don't think we ever find enough tutors to help. It is challenging because, as you know, and as you've mentioned already, we're having difficulty finding staff in various areas that we may get into a little bit later. But tutors in particular, what's good is that we have some flexibility on who we can hire and what qualifications they need to have. Initially, when we're hiring tutors, we try to get certified teachers. But, of course, with the number of tutors and support we need, they don't have to be certified teachers to serve in this capacity. But here in Chesapeake, we have $14.7 million actually allotted through the end of 25-26 school year, and about 55% of that, or $8 million, will be spent on tutoring K through 8, reading and mathematics. But in particular, we're having trouble getting students to stay after school. So after school and in the evening and even on the weekends is a challenge. So one of the things that we've been trying to do in Chesapeake is to provide support during the day. And that's been lots of creative scheduling and work with our schools to find times during the day that we can support our students, because that way we can make sure they're getting the support they need while they're with us during the school day.
And we've been taking a similar approach. We have hired 57 tutors already. We only have 2.5 million because we're a much smaller division. Right. And 1.5 million is dedicated to tutoring over the next couple of years. So there are 55 tutors hired, but there's about 70 elementary teachers and 61 middle school teachers who are actually taking on a tutoring role as well, which is a lot of extra work, but teachers are willing to do it to help our students. And so they're tutoring. We have programs after school, which again, we're having difficulty getting students to come. And we also are using some of the tutoring resources during the school day as well. But I think the approach we're taking, where we're looking at online grade level content, grade level skills, and filling the gaps with tutoring, I think that approach is really, really working.
We are taking your calls. What are your thoughts on learning loss and factors affecting today's classrooms? 757-440-1665. You can also post to the W8RO Facebook page, and we will return in just 1 minute. Back with Dr. Olwen Herron from the Williamsburg James City County Schools and Dr. Jared Cotton with the Chesapeake City Schools. The pandemic, the effects went beyond learning and attendance, but also had some impact on social skills of the kids, especially elementary school. Is that, am I guessing that correctly?
Yes, I would say that's accurate. We have had lots of mental health challenges for all students, I would say, K through 12. But I would say in particular our youngest learners. We've had some issues with adapting to school and adjusting to the school environment and the structure of school. And you have to remember that we had some very young students who spent up to 2 years outside of school at home. And so many of them are coming to school for the first time in second grade. They've already missed their kindergarten year and their first grade year in the building. So that's where a lot of those challenges come into play. And we certainly need support for those students to help them adjust. We also need support through counselors, which I know over the years they have been increasing the guidance counselor ratio to help support our students. But we've also been working with local partners and community partners to help with mental health. And we just don't have enough mental health practitioners to assist us with these challenges we're facing.
Yeah, I think it's one of the greatest staffing needs that we have is actually filling the positions of school psychologists, school counselors. We've been very fortunate. Our board made a commitment 2 years ago to go to one counselor to 250 students ratio, which is the national recommended average, and that really has impacted how we can serve students and counsel students individually and in groups within all of our schools, and that really has helped us with some of the mental health issues as well.
That affects learning too, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Because if the child is stressed because of the world around them, then they're not paying quite enough attention.
Yeah, that goes back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, you can't learn if you don't feel safe, secure, then you're going to have trouble concentrating at school.
We talked about the children. What about the teachers? How are they coping post-pandemic?
I think it's been an incredibly stressful time for teachers. I think the more we value, ask them what they need, support them in the classroom, provide the resources they need, and just are there for them at the school level and at the division level is extremely important. I mean, I think it speaks for itself. The turnover rate and the number of teachers leaving the profession, And I think everything we can do to keep them is vitally important. I think really wraparound services for teachers are just as important at the school level as they are for students. And the community at large valuing them and thanking them. But I would say to everyone today, if you're listening to this radio session today, reach out to a teacher and say thank you.
What are your teachers telling you about kids in the classroom and dealing with coming back to the school?
Well, I would say that conversation has changed over time, mm-hmm. because when they first came back, a lot of the responses I was getting from administrators and teachers is it was quite the challenge for students and staff to readjust to being back in school and being back in the classroom. Because you remember, when you're learning at home, you can get up and get something to drink, or you can walk around the room, or what I like to say, you can wear your PJs, you know, during instruction.
I discovered I could go to church that way too.
yeah, just business on top and, you know, PJs on the bottom. So of course, so we've had that conversation, and then of course readjusting to that. So our principals have told us that there were a lot of behavior challenges and frustrations on all sides, but a lot of that has greatly improved over the last couple of years now that we've gotten back to a sense of normalcy in our schools. But initially, it was quite a challenge.
I think teachers will also tell you, and I've heard many, many times going out to schools to visit, they want to be there. They want to be in person with the students. What they had to create during the pandemic was really an incredible amount of work for them. And to have the students right there in front of them is really where they love to be, having that relationship and teaching them every single day.
Did you notice, was there an uptick in homeschooling that kids went away and just didn't come back?
Well, during the pandemic, we did have quite an increase in homeschool requests, and that was to be expected. We haven't fully recovered all of those families coming back to public school, but in Chesapeake, we did launch the Chesapeake Virtual Academy, which is something that we had planned to develop anyway, but the pandemic, as you know, accelerated that. And what's interesting is now we offer a K-12 online, fully virtual program where we have part-time asynchronous learning for the high school students. And we have K-8. We offer synchronous and asynchronous instruction for those students throughout the day. And surprisingly, our kindergarten students, we have kindergarten students who are doing extremely well in the online program.
Asynchronous. In other words, I could sleep through the day and take my classes at night.
Yes, asynchronous. You can work on it at your own pace, and that's at our high school level. The synchronous is where the teacher provides the instruction in real time, but even in that scenario, there are breaks throughout the day where students work independently. And we have had great success with our youngest learners. Like I've always said, virtual learning is great for some students, not all students. Right. But what we have found is we have some of our homeschool families have come back to public school because of the virtual opportunity. And what we have families who travel the globe. We have a family who's on a boat year-round traveling. We have families who travel throughout the United States, and their children stay connected with Chesapeake Public Schools virtually.
Dr. Heron? You have a similar experience?
We don't have a virtual academy like Chesapeake. We did have one that we obviously raised up during the pandemic, which went very well, but the interest diminished each year since the pandemic. Students are offered the opportunity for full-time virtual learning through Virtual Virginia, so that's how we offer that opportunity for students.
Are we reaching a new normal where we're going to have to do these kinds of different things?
I think what we need to do as educators, it's all about personalizing for our students. I've had experiences over the years where I have students who are into athletics, whether it's gymnastics or seriously involved in some sport and at the competitive level where they have to miss school. And in the old school education, we say you have to go to school every day from 8 to 3. And here's our schedule. You have to be in person. And we have to adapt and be flexible because we have students who are pursuing all kinds of opportunities that are all valuable and important to their learning and development. And as a school division, we have to offer those opportunities for them to explore those things, where in the past, we would say if you didn't fit in this mold with the schedule, you couldn't pursue that. And so I do think that the good thing that came out of the pandemic, if there are any good things, is it did accelerate our use of technology and our personalization for students.
A reminder, our phone numbers are 757-440-2665, 800-940-2240. Also, you can post a question to the WHRO Facebook page. Dr. Herron, Dr. Cotton mentioned new opportunities. There are some positive things that came out of the pandemic, are there not?
Absolutely. And I do think virtual learning was one of them. And the use of technology greatly advanced during the pandemic and continues to accelerate year by year. And so I think there's a lot more technology used in the classroom than what was used before. Prior to the pandemic, we didn't have a computer in every single child's hand or a laptop, and now we do. And that was as a result of the pandemic as well.
Is that making kids more tech savvy?
I believe so.
I would think so. They were particularly tech savvy ahead of time. In a lot of our school divisions, we had a 3 to 5 year plan to get one-to-one technology in the hands of our students. And I like to tell my staff that turned into a 3-month plan where we purchased devices for all of our students very quickly. We used to have a bring your own device policy where our students could use their cell phones or bring their own devices. But what's been interesting is, I don't know if it's the case in Williamsburg, James City County, but we have pushed back on cell phones in our schools because they have become such a distraction. And now that we have devices for our students, there's no need for them to have their cell phones.
Yeah, Dr. Cotton, we've done that as well. We've really limited the use of cell phones in schools, and it really has helped engagement and learning.
I want to expand on that in a minute, but right now I think we have a caller. Hello, Derek from Williamsburg.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for the superintendent is, given the benefit of hindsight, would you do anything differently now? Knowing what you know.
Okay.
That's a great question, Derek. I'll have a go at it first and then pass to Dr. Cotton. I think looking back, we really didn't know what we were dealing with for a long time from a safety perspective. And potentially we would have tried to come back into the learning environment physically a little bit earlier. I think there's a balancing act there because we were concerned about teachers and students. And we certainly didn't want to lose teachers who were frightened to come back into the classroom. But I think in retrospect, we would have moved a little bit quicker.
Yeah, I think you can always look back and see that there are things that we could have done differently or better. I am proud of the fact that in Chesapeake, we did bring our students back earlier. And we were an outlier in our region, which was very scary because I was one of the school divisions that we prioritized our most vulnerable learners. We brought back our youngest learners first. We brought back our special education students as well as our English language learners. And we brought them back 5 days a week, which wasn't popular at the time. And then, of course, as Dr. Owen said, we didn't know what to experience. We didn't know what we were facing. And we were all trying to put measures or metrics on ourselves and saying, when this happens, this is going to happen. And I'm glad that we just said, we're not going to do that because we don't know what we're dealing with. And we're not going to create arbitrary, thresholds. But I would say, and when you look back, I mean, we had students and staff wearing masks and shields, and we had, we had desk barriers, and there were so many things happening that I wish I did not have to do any of those things because it really impeded the instructional process. But in hindsight, I would say that we did everything we could to bring them back, and unfortunately, I spent funding on some things that I wish I hadn't. But I did it so that we could have our students in school.
Well, I think we all did that. We tried to protect it every way we could and keep education moving forward. And we did a similar thing, Dr. Cotton. We brought our most vulnerable students back first and gradually brought everyone back. But all I can say is I'm glad we're back.
Thank you for the call, Derek. You brought up cell phones, and I want to talk about that a little more. Virginia Beach said, put your cell phones away during class. I have friends who are teachers who it was a daily battle getting the kids off the cell phones, texting and playing games and everything else. The Virginia Beach model, is that working? Is that working with you? Do your kids put their cell phones away?
Well, last year we actually put a stop to the cell phones at the middle school level. Elementary students don't bring them. At high school, this year, we just implemented off and away during the day. The only exception is they can use their cell phones during lunch. I have to tell you, I talk to students quite a bit. And when I meet with students, particularly our student leaders, they made comments that they don't particularly like it, but they know it's necessary because the cell phones have become such a distraction. And we've looked at a lot of research that students are distracted by the cell phones and the texting and everything else in class. But I have to tell you that since we've implemented this year, we have seen a significant decrease in behaviors related to cell phone use and or social media type things. So that has been a great plus. And we've also heard from teachers that it has really improved student engagement in school. And we've even had some funny stories where students are actually, you know, playing chess or playing board games at lunch instead of using their phones. So we've actually had teachers say that it's really interesting, and principals saying it's really interesting to see students now engaging more in person than they have in the past.
Dr. Herron?
I think it's been most advantageous for teachers because they're not asking students to put phones away every single day. Similarly, no cell phones at middle school. They are allowed them at high school, but it's during between classes and lunchtime, and the only time they're used in the classroom is if the teacher's using the cell phones for a particular activity. So it really has been a game changer, I think, in re-engaging students in learning.
Our numbers, 757-440-2665, 800-940-2240. Our guests are Dr. Jared Cotton, superintendent of the Chesapeake City Public Schools, and Dr. Olwen Herron from the Williamsburg James City County Schools. We'll be right back. You're listening to Education Matters. It's Education Matters, and it's coming to you from WHRV this afternoon. Our numbers, 757-440-2665. If you have a question, 800-940-2240. Also, you can post a question to the WHRO Facebook page. Talking about specific issues for each one of the district, Dr. Cotton, after school clubs, has that been resolved?
Yeah, we do think we're in a good place with our after-school clubs. You know, there was lots of talk and controversy about the use of our school buildings, and we're not unlike other school divisions where we allow outside groups to rent or utilize our facilities for a fee. And then, of course, one of the things that we know to be the case is that whenever you do that, you have to be fair and consistent with all groups that want to use your facilities. I don't know if you have this case in your school division, but we have churches who sometimes use our facilities for a period of time temporarily. So we have continued to revise and adjust our facility use processes over the past several months. And right now, it seems that we're in a good place with
good.
That.
Dr. Herron, your district is dealing with a potential, for lack of a better word, divorce or amicable split, or what was the root cause of that, and where did it start?
I think it started with the city of Williamsburg as part of their strategic planning process. One of their goals was to look at and explore ways to have the best possible education for the children of Williamsburg City. And I think that led to reaching out to have a study done to see what that would look like. And one of the possibilities was a go-it-alone city system. I think in response to that, then with the possibility of a split, the county then authorized a study to see what that would mean for them in case we were in two different systems.
So there's two separate studies going on.
There's two separate studies, both by colleagues, former superintendents, that are being conducted right now. From what I understand, the city of Williamsburg should have their study by the end of January, beginning of February, and I believe the county one is due a couple of months later. But hard to imagine after 70 years of a joint system, two systems splitting, because we've had a wonderful relationship and a wonderful school system.
Our number is 757-440-2665, 800-940-2240, or post your question or comment to the WHRO Facebook page. In a split like that, it's got to cost more because you've got all the back office things that would have to be duplicated, right?
I would imagine it's going to cost the smaller system more, who would need to put resources into central office staffing. However, that's part of both studies. Both the financial implications will be a huge piece of that, and how to split all of the assets as well.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to. The one article I read said all three high schools are outside the Williamsburg city limits.
That's correct. That's correct. And I believe if there is a split, the county will need to build a middle school. So my understanding from the outside is if it moves forward, we'll know probably by June of this year. And then we'll have 3 years to plan and actually move in a different direction. Of course, as superintendent, we are WJCC schools, and I believe we're better together.
Yeah. Well, that will play out. When do you think you'll be getting the reports?
I think the reports are due certainly before April. I think the Williamsburg City one may come first, and then... A decision will be made by June 24.
As they look at that, do they look at the effect that might have on the kids and about learning? And I might be going to a different... I moved halfway through my high school experience, and it was traumatic.
I think it's going to look very different for both entities. Every school will look different. There's going to have to be redistricting, new boundaries, new systems. Everything will literally change.
What are you hearing from parents about that?
Not a lot so far. As we've been provided information that has gone public, I've kept staff informed, I've kept parents informed. This is what we know is happening so far. And certainly with staff at the beginning of this year, I was very much, we still are WJCC. Let's focus on the work. Let's focus on student learning. Let's focus on what we're doing for the next year and let everything play out behind the scenes.
Are you hearing anything from the kids?
I think students, from what I've heard talking to individual students, I think there's concerns about what it'll do to the fine arts and athletics program in a smaller system that's going to be hard to replicate because we have a wonderful fine arts and a wonderful athletic program right now.
What I'm thinking all in VA to change the subject here and the governor's comments laid a lot at that at the foot of the Northam administration and changing metrics and all kinds of talk. Are we in a better place now than we were 4 years ago?
Well, that's a tough question to answer because as educators, we monitor student progress yearly,
right.
and actually daily, but as a school division, certainly yearly. I would say that I'm better off as far as many resources that we have had available to us, largely due to ESSER funding,
right.
As we shared earlier, that allowed us to move forward with purchasing technology equipment, you know, in Chesapeake, as is in Williamsburg, James City County, we're one-to-one technology. All of our students have a laptop. We have also added technology to our classrooms to support learning in all of our learning spaces. And of course, we've been able to address some facility needs that we've been in dire need to address, like HVAC systems in many of our schools using ESSER funds. The challenge that we face now, and of course, those are federal funds that were provided to us. But
just to be clear, ESSER funds are, again?
Yeah.
Federal funds.
Federal funds, grant funding that we received and really in response to the pandemic. So it has allowed us to do a lot of things over the past couple of years, but it goes away. It's not going to continue to come to us moving forward. Of course, as we mentioned with staff shortages, we're actually using some of that funding to help with staff shortages,
right.
with bonuses and so forth. But again, as we close out this year, much of that funding will be gone. So what we really need to look at is what are we doing beyond that? So from an academic standpoint, I think that we have not fully recovered to our pre-pandemic achievement, but we are making great strides in that area. And I'm incredibly encouraged by our teachers, our staff, our administrators, and the hard work of our students, because when we've looked at our student achievement data, we continue to make a full recovery, and we're not quite where we want to be, but we're getting much closer.
Dr. Yeah. Heron?
We've had a similar experience. I think we've had a steady increase in student achievement over the last couple of years, and particular increase in K-2 in our PALS assessment. We had a 16% increase, almost back to pre-pandemic levels, which has been wonderful. So I think all the potential and the momentum is there to get back to where we were. I think we're all on course. I don't just worry about ESSER funds disappearing. All-in funding is is one-time funding as well.
Right.
And so my question would be, the wonderful resources that we've been given for math and for reading, will they exist after the money goes away? Because currently our teachers are trained, they're putting big effort into using the resources, and we need them to continue.
All in, to go back to one-time funding. One-time funding doesn't help continuing programs. It's a shot in the arm, I guess, so to speak, but you can't plan anything long-term with that kind of money.
That's why what's happening in the General Assembly right now is extremely important for next year.
General Assembly, the JLARC report indicated, the number that comes to mind, and it may be wrong in my head, about $2,000 per student that we are not spending, that other states around us are spending on their schools. And there's a number of things going on in the General Assembly this year to address that. And what are the chances of something coming out of that that will be some kind of continuing money?
I think I'm very positive about the bills that are going through the General Assembly right now. I know you are as well, Dr. Cotton, in terms of looking at teacher salaries, possibility of removing the support cap in funding, which will make money flow back to the
support cap. Help me understand that.
There was a cap put on the number of support employees that were funded under SOQ. And if that's removed, like, for example, teacher assistants, some of our teacher assistants, a small number are actually were provided funding for, but most were not. So most of those are locally funded.
Yeah. And SOQ is standards of quality. Those are certain staffing requirements that we all get for all of our school divisions. We fund well beyond the standards of quality, because if you only funded standards of quality,
right,
you wouldn't be able to run a school division. Yeah. So that's important. And we're very encouraged. In Chesapeake, we did a 10% raise to our teachers, much to the dismay of my colleagues a couple of years ago. But we've really been trying to work on increasing teacher salaries over the last several years. But as I've mentioned, we have critical shortage areas for bus drivers, school nutrition workers, and custodians. And I say critical shortage areas because, you know, we have as many as 100 bus drivers we're short this year that we're continuing to struggle with for the past couple of years. So we definitely need to have competitive salaries for those employee groups. They work hard each and every day, especially now, because they're covering for other people who are not there filling those roles. But now we're competing with lots of other businesses. You know, when you can work at Amazon or drive boxes rather than children, and you make more money per hour, we're finding that we're having to really be more competitive with our salaries.
But you're also competitive with other districts.
Of course.
How much of that goes on?
Well, fortunately for Dr. Heron, she's on the other side of
the peninsula. So we're not competing.
You two aren't competing.
We're still friends, right?
But
now.
I do remember a year or two ago, two cities that are right next door to each other. One of them was offering $5,000 signing bonus for new teachers, and the other one had been offering $5,000 and went to $6,000. And then the other one went to $6,000. So there is some competition between districts, is there not?
There certainly is, and that used to be our competition. But as I said earlier, now we're competing against so many other employers, right?
That's true. And I think with teachers in particular, because of the shortage and because of the desire to have a quality teacher in every single classroom, that we have to remain competitive with each other. But having said that, we do collaborate, we share what we're doing, we work together as a superintendent's group in Region 2, and really do support each other in so many ways as well.
Teachers leaving when they retire, what reasons are they giving? Or retire or just leave? What reasons are you hearing?
Retiring, leaving the area, and more often, unfortunately, going into different professions.
They are. We did have a significant turnover during the pandemic, but when we looked at those numbers, we noticed a large percentage of those were already at the retirement age. And our sense is that they would have worked a few more years had the pandemic not happened, and then they went ahead and retired. But what I'm encouraged by is, being a military community, we do have teachers and staff who move around all over the United States. But with our virtual academy, we actually have retained some of our teachers who are now leaving the area. They stay connected virtually, and we have teachers all over the United States who are still connected with Chesapeake Public Schools. So that's been an interesting thing that's occurred with the virtual program that I wasn't expecting, but it's been nice.
I think we've really made lots of different strategies to keep our teachers and to employ new teachers. We ended up being 99.6% staffed on day one of last year with teachers, which was really, really encouraging. Prior to the pandemic, we were 100% every single year. And I think part of that is offering contracts early, reaching out to colleges and forming partnerships with students coming through into teaching, and also trying to encourage some of our support staff, our TAs, who are working with instruction in the classroom to become teachers. So we're supporting a lot of support staff, TAs, teacher assistants, with help this year to actually become teachers.
I'm glad you said that, because we have a teacher career ladder where our teacher assistants now can go. We have partnerships with universities where our teacher assistants can go and get certified to be a teacher, and at minimal cost or no cost to become certified. And we also, you probably do too, we have a student program where we have guaranteed contracts we give to our students who are teachers for tomorrow, which is one of our programs, where they get a guaranteed contract in 4 years when they come back after they graduate to come and work for us. So we've been able to hire a lot of our students in the future, which has really helped us.
We're trying everything, and we're being successful, and we still have wonderful teachers in our classrooms.
757-440-2665, 800-940-2240, or you can post a question or comment to the WHRO Facebook page. We'll be right back. And we're back. It's Education Matters. It's coming to you from WHRV this afternoon. The numbers, 757-440-2665, 800-940-2240, also to the WHRO Facebook page. We have Tom from Currituck. Tom, you're on the air.
Yes, how do you do? I'm calling to ask what the schools are doing regarding ubiquitous financial literacy education for all students before they graduate high school, particularly things like the rule of 72, which I only learned when I was 54.
Go ahead.
Tom, I'm not sure about the rule of 72. I'm not familiar with it. However, every single student in Virginia is required to have a class in a course in financial literacy to graduate, and that every single student has that opportunity to learn.
Yeah, I was going to say, in Virginia, all of our students are required to take the course in financial literacy. That was added several years ago. And I would also say that with our career and technical education programs, what we try to do is run like a business where our students learn how to manage money and work in that regard, because that's such an important lesson for our students to learn. But that was added several years ago in Virginia, and I think it was a good addition, of course.
When I was a child, when I was in high school, not only did we have a class on keeping a checkbook, but we also had to walk around with a 10-pound bag of sugar that was the baby.
Mm-hmm. But I do appreciate the question because there are so many financial lessons that our students need to learn. And many times you don't learn it until you've made all the wrong decisions, you know, after you graduate or go on beyond high school. So what a great question, how important that is. I know in some schools, in my past experiences, we've run banks within the schools. We've partnered with local banks to help teach students about financial literacy. And we actually partnered, I want to say, last year with a group in our community. I'm losing the name of the group. I want to say it was 4-H probably that we worked with at a couple of our high schools where they did a financial literacy workshop for students. And it was kind of funny to watch because the students had a certain amount of money and then they had to draw cards that told them, your car just broke down. How right. are you going to address this? And you need groceries. Or your brother-in-law just moved in with you or something like that. And they had to deal with that. So any type of money matters opportunities, I think, are important. It's not required, but we've been adding that to some of our schools.
Absolutely. And also a big focus as well is just being ready for a career or college is a focus at every single one of our schools as well.
Janet had a comment on Facebook. She said she did not get real life financial literacy. And have you done studies to determine which students need that? Or is it just a blanket that everyone gets it?
I think it's a blanket that everyone gets it. And it's actually required to graduate. And I think it was a great addition to the requirements for graduation.
Like so many things, the requirements come down from the state and from Department of Education, from lawmakers. How often do you have contact with lawmakers and the Department of Education and the people who make these rules?
Well, that's so important. We actually do a legislative breakfast with our local legislators. We do that every year. And of course, we invite them to school visits. I mean, we have legislators who visit our schools on a regular basis. As a matter of fact, I just had a legislator recently visit our career center just a couple of weeks ago. So we do have opportunities that we create for that. We monitor bills that are being proposed, and we check those very regularly. We make connections with our lawmakers. We give them our numbers, our cell numbers. They call us for feedback. And a matter of fact, next week we're going to visit with them up in Richmond. I know we are. I think you are,
yep,
as well, right?
Absolutely. We are. I'm heading up to Richmond on Monday with several of board members, and we will be visiting all of our legislators and providing some input into the legislative agenda for next year.
Let's go to Denise in Chesapeake with a question. Hi, Denise. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having my question. My name is Denise, and I'm from Chesapeake. I am a retired central office staff here in Virginia. I'm curious to know, a lot of teachers are leaving because they feel like they have no administrative support for severe behaviors in the classroom. And I'm wondering if there's a procedure that Chesapeake or Williamsburg has in place to determine when a child needs to go to the office or when a child can be managed, the behavior can be managed by the teachers.
I think that's a great question of every single classroom. I think when a teacher is able to manage the behavior within his or her own classroom, that is the best possible first stage. But when a student is, when the behavior can't get managed, then of course a principal is called to help or an assistant principal. And I know in our beginning of this year and last year, we put a big emphasis on being there right away to support teachers in the classroom because we were aware of the growing behavioral issues, especially in the early grades. So the role of the principal and assistant principal are really, really important in supporting the teacher right now.
And I would agree with Dr. Heron on that. But I would also add that one of the things that we've been investing in Chesapeake as well, I'm sure in Williamsburg, James City County, are behavior specialists, folks that we've been hiring to work directly with teachers and administrators and staff to really help address those severe behaviors, to provide support in ways to identify the antecedent or what's happening in the classroom that's leading to those behaviors, and ways that we can address them. And of course, sometimes the student has to be removed from the classroom for a period of time. Ultimately, we don't want to do that. We want to try other things to help support, and we definitely need to engage our parents in supporting us with that as well. But I would say the behavior specialists have been a great addition. We actually have some who are housed at different schools to work directly with students and staff.
And we've added several similar positions, behavior specialists, in the last 2 years. I think we've added three in Williamsburg. And also another big piece of that has been having a 1-to-250 counselor ratio, where we've more counselors to intervene and work with students individually and in groups as well.
We are just about out of time. I want to thank you for being with us today. Dr. Jared Cotton from Chesapeake, Dr. Olwen Herron from the Williamsburg James City County Schools, and thank you for joining us for Education Matters. With both Chesapeake and Williamsburg James City County Schools are members of HERETA, which holds the license for the WHRO stations. I am Doug Boynton, our show produced by Dr. Barry Graham, our audio engineer Jordan Christie. Connor Worley answers our phones. Our theme music is an original composition by WHRO's Todd Washburn. Special thanks to Chuck Dowd, Heather Mazzoni, and Bert Schmidt. And remember, education matters.